His subject sounds very interesting. Graves of lust. Graves of lust. Brother Monet.
Julie and I count it a pleasure to be here in Chicago this morning. We bring with us the love of the brethren whom we meet with in the Hartford Ecclesia in Hartford, Connecticut. We have just a short stay. We got in yesterday afternoon, and we'll be leaving this afternoon. But we've had a nice fellowship with the Kendalls. Also, we had a nice visit in the Hagensack home. So it's been a very, very blessed visit thus far. Our topic for this morning, as Brother Art mentioned, is graves of lust. The expression graves of lust is the marginal reading of the word, Hebrew word, Kibroth Hathava, which is found in Numbers 11:34. And it's in reference to those Israelites who, in the wilderness of Paran, grew tired of the manna from heaven and lusted after the food that they had eaten back in Egypt. The Lord, in his displeasure, let them eat their fill of what they were craving by miraculously supplying them with a phenomenal number of quail. But it cost many of them their lives. Like many of Israel's experiences, this was intended to be an example to spiritual Israel. And as we consider this experience in the wilderness of Paran, we will find lessons that will help us as we're being led through our wilderness experiences. So turn with me, if you will, to Numbers 11. We're going to read the account. We'll be jumping around just a bit. We're going to begin in Numbers 11, verses 4 through 6. Numbers 11, 4 through 6. And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes." Verses 16 to 23. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be of the elders of the people, and officers over them, and bring them unto the tabernacle of congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down and talk with thee there, and I will take the spirit which is upon thee, and I will put it upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with thee, that thou bear it not thyself alone. And say thou unto the people, Sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, and ye shall eat flesh. For ye have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, Who shall give us flesh to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you flesh, and ye shall eat. Ye shall not eat one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, neither 10 days, nor 20 days, but even a whole month, until it come out of your nostrils. And it shall be loathsome unto you, because that ye have despised the Lord which is among you, and have wept before him, saying, Why came we forth out of Egypt? And Moses said, The people among whom I am are 600,000 footmen, and thou hast said, I will give them flesh, that they may eat a whole month. Shall the flocks and the herds be slain for them to suffice them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to suffice them? And the Lord said unto Moses, Is the Lord's hand waxed short? Thou shalt see now whether my word shall come to pass unto thee or not. And verses 31 to 34. And there went forth a wind from the Lord, and brought quails from the sea, and let them fall by the camp, as it were a day's journey on this side, and as it were a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp, and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. And the people stood up all that day, and all that night, and all the next day, and they gathered the quails. He that gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a very great plague. And he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattava, because there they buried the people that lusted. Now, in considering this account, we should keep in mind that the Israelites were all natural men. There were about 2 million people living under very difficult conditions. They had none of the comforts of home and all of the hardships of surviving on little more than what was absolutely necessary. So to think that the Israelites had more of a murmuring and complaining disposition than the rest of humanity is not necessarily true. Now, prior to this experience, the Israelites had spent just under a year, about 11 months, at Mount Sinai. During this stay, the priesthood was organized, the tabernacle was constructed, its religious services were instituted. During this time, they were also organized politically and militarily. It was really a year of great advancement and accomplishment in transforming them from a great mass of unorganized immigrants into the beginnings of what was to become a powerful nation. And this all being accomplished during the sojourn at Sinai, the cloud lifted from the tabernacle, the people broke camp, and they started on their journey toward the promised land. 3 days and about 20 miles later, the cloud settled over Paran, another wilderness area. But unlike Sinai, it was a much harsher environment and less adapted to the care of their flocks and their herds. This change in circumstances brought fresh trials of faith in the Lord and in his promises. It was while in Paran that the people again began to murmur and complain. In verse 4, we're told it was the mixed multitude among them that first fell a-lusting. As to who this mixed multitude was, we can be reasonably certain that they were not of pure Israeli blood. They were probably the offspring of marriages between the Israelites and the native population of Egypt, marriages that were not sanctioned of the Lord and which should not have been entered into. And this mixed multitude might have also included Egyptians or foreigners from other nations who had attached themselves to Israel. This mixed multitude were the first to lust after the things left behind in Egypt, but then the children of Israel joined right in with them. And isn't it just so true of how complaining is contagious? Usually if one baby starts crying, pretty soon the other babies, who were all perfectly content, start crying right along with them. And we oftentimes act in this same childish way. Once one of us starts complaining, the rest of us just naturally join right in. It seems to be a condition of the fallen human nature, a condition that we constantly have to fight against. So the children of Israel wept for flesh to eat. But what were they truly murmuring and bitterly complaining about? They were sick and tired of the Lord's provision. They thought the way of life the Lord had guided them into had gotten too hard, and they wanted to go back to Egypt where it was easier. But just how long had they been eating manna in the wilderness that they came to hate it so much? According to Exodus 16:1, they first got the manna on the 15th day of the second month. It was now 3 days after the 20th day of the second month of the second year, according to Numbers 10:11 and 10:33, which reads, "And it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from off the tabernacle of the testimony," in verse 33, "and they departed from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them in the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them." So they had been eating manna for about 368 days, or just over a year. Now, when the Lord first gave it to them, a month after leaving Egypt, they had run out of rations. Their little ones were probably crying, and they just couldn't comprehend how they were possibly going to feed themselves out in the wilderness. The idea that they were going to die of starvation was very real. And their thoughts naturally returned to the fullness of bread they had back in Egypt. But the Lord did not find fault with their asking for some of the bare necessities of life. And he didn't chastise them for asking for their daily bread. He knew that they needed to eat. So in answer to their cry over a year ago, he sent them quail that very evening and manna the next morning. But he had waited until they understood their undone condition, until they really felt their need, so that when he provided for them, they would appreciate it. And at first, they did appreciate their daily bread, even though it did take a lot of effort to collect it and to prepare it. We're told in verse 8 of Numbers 11 that they had to gather it, grind it in mills, or beat it in a mortar, and then bake it in pans. But after eating the same thing over and over, day in and day out for weeks, and then months, they began to take it for granted, then to consider it common and boring, and finally to despise it. And it's not because it didn't taste good. It tasted of honey and oil. But now that their bread was sure, they wanted more than just their daily sustenance. They wanted some variety. They wanted the garlic and the onions of Egypt to add some spice to what they had come to consider as their boring and predictable fare. And there is likewise a danger for those of us who have been privileged to eat of the true bread that came down from heaven to fall into a similar pattern of thinking. At first, the truth of God and his divine plan is found to be precious and sweet, the very thing we'd been longing for and even starving for. But over time, we may lose the taste for our first love and come to regard the work of daily gathering and grinding too much work that takes up too much time, time that could be spent doing or looking into things more appealing to the natural inclinations, thinking there's no harm in adding just a little variety to spice up our predictable fare. And if this line of thought is not reined in, but is persisted in and nourished, it will lead to a lukewarm attitude toward the truth and the privileges and responsibilities that go with it. Now, in response to the people's murmuring for flesh a second time, God sent word to the people through Moses that in his displeasure, he was about to send them flesh food in the form of quail. And you will eat it for a whole month until it come out of your nostrils, and it will be loathsome unto you. Now, the question naturally arises, did the manna continue unabated for those 30 days, or would it have ceased so that they would have had nothing but quail to eat to better impress the lesson that the gratification of their own selfish desires did not lead to health and happiness, but to sickness and even to death? We're not told that the manna ceased, but an argument might be made that it is inferred and that they ate quail until it became loathsome. They ate quail until it came out of their nostrils. Now, this seems to imply that they had no other choice. If they had manna, they could have taken a break from the quail. When they started to get tired of it, they could switch over to the manna, or they could eat some of each during their meal, providing a nice variety of bread and meat. But it seems as if they did not have a choice, indicating that the manna may not have fallen for those 30 days. Now, whether this is so or not, and there's no way to be certain, there is still the lesson in this for us, that we only have one proper choice in what we should eat to maintain our spiritual vitality during our wilderness experience. We're not to eat from the table of the Lord and from the table of the world. We can't have it both ways and enjoy the spiritual health that the Lord intends for us. We can choose either the manna from heaven or the various offerings of the world, but we can't choose both. And as the Lord only gives us one choice, so it appears he may have given the Israelites only one choice in what they would eat. And he miraculously sent enough quail to feed 2 million people for 30 days, as we read in verses 31 to 34. Now, there are details given in these four verses that raise several questions. To begin, what do we make of the expression in verse 31, that there went forth a wind from the Lord and brought quails from the sea? Normally, when we think of the sea in the area of the Sinai, we think of either the Mediterranean Sea to the north or the Red Sea to the south. And keeping in mind that the Sinai Peninsula is bounded on the south by the two arms of the Red Sea, on its west is the Gulf of Suez, and on its east is the Gulf of Aqaba. From the account given in Numbers 11, we can't tell which of these seas the quail were blown in from. But from Psalm 78, we're given certain information which would lead us to conclude that the quail would have crossed either the Red Sea or one of its two arms, the Gulf of Suez or the Gulf of Aqaba, near the southernmost tip of the Sinai. But at some point, while they were crossing, or after they had crossed the sea, the Lord caused a wind to blow, which took them out of their intended flight path and caused them to drop exhausted around the camp of the Israelites in the wilderness of Paran, which is about 50 miles north of the southern tip of the Sinai. Now, you might want to turn to Psalm 78, but also keep your place in Numbers 11. We'll be referring to both of these accounts for the remainder of our time. Psalm 78, verses 26 and 27 reads, "He caused an east wind to blow in the heaven, and by his power he brought in the south wind. He rained flesh also upon them as dust, and feathered fowls like as the sand of the sea." We see that the wind from the Lord was a violent crosswind blowing from east to west and south to north. It is because the wind is from the south, which means it is blowing towards the north, that we think the quail were blown in from the Red Sea, which is to the south of the wilderness of Paran. In order for the quail to be blown in from the Mediterranean Sea, the wind would have had to have been a north wind blowing in a southerly direction. Now, turning back to Numbers 11, what is to be made of this statement in verse 31, that they fell a day's journey round about the camp, as it were, 2 cubits or 3 feet high upon the face of the earth? I understand this to mean that they did not fall at all in the camp, but only in the unoccupied areas, a day's journey around the outskirts of the camp. This allowed them to keep the camp in the same location for at least the 30 days that they ate quail. If the quail had fallen in the camp in such fantastic numbers, it would have forced them to move to a new location, uncluttered with quail. As the friends will recall, the Israelites camped around the four sides of the court of the tabernacle. The quail fell starting at the edges of the unoccupied areas of the four sides of the camp and continued to fall outward a full day's journey. We're not told specifically how far a day's journey was, but a conservative estimate would be at least 5 miles. Smith's Bible Dictionary says that when they traveled in companies, a day's journey is 10 miles. And as to them being 3 feet high upon the ground, there are at least 2 different ways to look at it. One is that they were flying 3 feet above the ground, and as this allowed the Israelites to physically knock them down to the ground and then to collect them. Well, this is entirely possible, and Brother Russell seems to favor this explanation. I would also offer a second interpretation for your consideration. That is that the physically exhausted quail literally did fall to the ground, as if the Lord was raining flesh upon them as dust, as it says in Psalm 78:27. And as Numbers 11:31 and 32 says, they fell by the camp, and rather than knocking them out of the air, the people simply gathered them from off the ground over a period of 2 days and 1 night. Now, if the quail fell to the ground instead of flying 3 feet above the ground, does this mean that they fell until they piled up 3 feet high? I believe they literally did pile up 3 feet above the ground. But we're not restricted to interpreting this to mean that there was a solid 3-foot pile of quail, perfectly distributed, a day's journey from each side of the camp. Because of the high winds and the fact that quail only weigh about 5.5 ounces, they would naturally be blown into drifts, much like snow does under similar conditions, the highest drifts being, in this case, 3 feet. The Tanakh Hebrew translation, I think, supports this interpretation as it reads in Numbers 11:31, "A wind from the Lord started up, swept quail from the sea, and strewed them over the camp, about a day's journey on this side and about a day's journey on that side, all around the camp, and some 2 cubits deep on the ground." In other words, some were piled or drifted 3 feet high, but not all of them were piled that high. Some would have been blown into smaller piles, and some areas probably wouldn't have had any quail at all. And this makes sense because, as verse 32 says, they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. This was done in order to dry them in the sun for preservation. And it would have had to have been done before decomposition began to set in. The quail, after having been split and cleansed, would have been laid out on the ground to be dried and preserved in the arid climate of the desert. But if they had covered the ground for a solid 3 feet, a day's journey all around the camp, I don't believe there would have been sufficient ground or sufficient time to prepare and lay out the birds before they began to decompose. And as to how much each collected, we're told that he that gathered least gathered 10 homers. Now, there's two ways that this might be interpreted. One is that the homer is a heap or a mound, which is the definition given in Strong's and in the Jusenius Hebrew lexicon. Given this definition, the homers spoken of in verse 32 do not denote a strict quantity of measure, but simply a heap or a mound. The homer is also defined in Smith's Bible Dictionary as a measure of dry things. The absolute value of the homer is stated to be 10¾ bushels by Josephus, but only 5½ bushels by the rabbinists. Using these values, he that gathered 10 homers would have gathered either 107½ bushels or 55 bushels. Well, whichever definition you prefer, be it heaps or bushels, the homers were collected, and the amount gathered in 36 hours were so great that they fed 2 million people for a whole month. We next come to the plague of death. If we read only verse 33 of Numbers 11, it would seem to indicate that those who died had not even swallowed their first bite before they were struck dead. But if we go to Psalm 78, in verses 29 and 30, we're given additional information which might indicate a different meaning. Psalm 78, verse 29, tells us that they ate till they were full, which seems to imply that they ate at least one meal to the full. Verse 30 tells us that they were not estranged from their lust. The word estranged used here is Strong's number 2114. Its meaning is to turn aside, to depart, meaning they had not yet turned aside or departed from lusting after quail flesh. In other words, it had not yet become loathsome to them when the wrath of God came. This thought is borne out in the Tanakh, which reads for Numbers 11, 30, and 31, they had not yet wearied of what they craved. The food was still in their mouths when God's anger flared up at them. This implies they were still eating and still craving more. They weren't yet sick and tired of it when they were smote with the plague. So as to the question of when the plague of death began, you could make an argument for three different scenarios. One is that the plague of death struck before the first mouthful was chewed and the flesh was still between their teeth. To my mind, this is the weaker of the three arguments. A second is that they had eaten their fill of that first meal, but instead of stopping, they continued to gorge themselves. It was then, at the end of the first meal, that the plague of death set in. And the third scenario is that they had eaten their fill for any number of meals, but not so many that they had lost their craving for this flesh food. It was at this time perhaps some days having gone by, that the plague of death set in. And as we're told in verse 33, it was a very great plague, and they buried many people. And again, if we had only this information, we would have to conclude that the plague of death struck randomly. But again, Psalm 78 and verse 31 adds vital information to the account. There we read that the wrath of God came upon them and slew the fattest of them and smote down the chosen men of Israel. The word fattest here is Strong's number 4924, and it means strong or robust. So it was not the weakest, but the strongest, and most likely included the very ones that were the loudest complainers about the manna and the leaders in lusting after the good things left behind in Egypt that were struck dead for their murmuring and complaining against the Lord's provision. Now our last question is, what was it that caused so many to die? Since God oftentimes uses means found naturally in our environment to produce his miracles, and since quail are medically documented to be toxic in some instances, some have argued for a completely natural explanation for the plague of death due to quail poisoning. In researching this, I came across two pieces of information that would seem to indicate that the Israelites did not die from quail poisoning, at least not as we understand it today. The first is that while quail poisoning makes you very sick, it is rarely fatal, and when it is only among the very elderly. There are no documented deaths among the young and healthy. The second has to do with when and where quail are toxic. Quail migrate twice a year. In the spring, they fly north from Africa to Europe and Russia. In the fall, they fly south back to Africa. The quail that still fly today over the Sinai are never toxic in the spring, which is the time of the year the Israelites died from eating quail. They are only medically documented to be toxic in the fall when they're in their southern migration. Now, no one knows for sure why they're then toxic. The best guess is that it's something they ate. So a completely natural explanation seems to be out of the question. Now, this leaves us with two possibilities. One is that God miraculously caused the northbound spring quail to be toxic when they naturally are not. And then he caused the strongest among them to be poisoned to death when they normally are not. Now, this is certainly possible because nothing is impossible with God. The second possibility is that the quail in and of themselves had nothing to do with the plague. The plague was directly sent upon the people by God as a punishment for their murmurings and in no sense is to be attributed to natural causes due to quail poisoning. And this too is plausible, and reasonable. Now, no matter which explanation appeals to you, the fact remains that it was by God's great power that the mighty men, most likely of warrior age, in the bloom of health, were bowed down to death with the flesh, as it were, still between their teeth. And as they buried their dead after this sad and terrible experience, what might they have been thinking? They had been given what they lusted for, but at what great cost? Was it really worth it? In hindsight, I'm sure none of them would think that it was. And what about us? What is the Lord teaching us in this? Is it not simply this, that our choices are a matter of life and death? Not necessarily only one choice, but a series and a pattern of choices over a longer period of time. We are now in our wilderness journey, feasting on the manna of the Lord's provision. But the way is cluttered with choices that can become obstacles to our spiritual life. If we give in to, or pamper, or lust after what our flesh craves, along any number of lines, be it self, or family, or the home, or the workplace, or pleasure, or a tendency to lust after new and different doctrines of our own making or of some other teachers, to whatever extent we crave any of these beyond what is reasonable and in many cases necessary, we are demonstrating a spirit of murmuring and discontent against the Lord and His provision of meat in due season. Natural Israel quite naturally lusted after the good things left behind in Egypt. The life that was easier, more comfortable, not so hard on the flesh. But in reality, they were slaves and prisoners in Egypt. Their murmuring and complaining demonstrated their preference for a full belly and the relatively easy life of Egypt over freedom and being God's chosen people, which could only be gained by faithfully enduring hardship in the wilderness. When we of spiritual Israel lust for the things left behind in the world, where we were once slaves and prisoners to sin, we're demonstrating that very same attitude. Once we are free, we should not look back with longing to the ways of captivity. If we find ourselves in any way murmuring against the Lord's provision and lusting after the ways of the world or the flesh, we may find ourselves in a similar position as were the Israelites in the wilderness of Paran. And God will allow us the opportunity of feasting to the full on whatever we desire. And if we continue to fill ourselves with these, we will surely make ourselves spiritually sick. And if we still refuse to rein in our selfish, fleshly appetites, they could become our graves of lust. And we too could find ourselves cut off from further opportunity to eat at the Lord's table. The experience of God's people in their wilderness journey are sometimes hard. Our choices are sometimes hard. And the right choices are oftentimes the hardest on the flesh to make. By the Lord's grace, may we continue to choose the reproaches of Christ rather than the treasures of the world, and to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. As we partake of the manna of our Heavenly Father's provision without murmuring and complaining, may our Lord's qualities become ours as we grow stronger in faith and the graces of His Spirit. May the Lord add His blessing and overrule anything that might have been said not according to His will.